Chapter 10. The Ever-Turning Sword. And he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims, and a flaming sword which turned every way, to keep the way of the tree of life. Genesis, chapter 3, verse 24. In his earliest secret notes, Darwin wonders if the lines of life in the Galapagos might have diverged simply by adapting to the strange new place in which they had alighted. They might have speciated simply by virtue of their isolation, as they altered further and further over time. In those first notes, Darwin imagines that enough small changes accumulating over enough geological time would be able to accomplish almost anything. Darwin implies as much in a famous scribble he made soon after the meeting with Gould over Darwin's finches. "Let a pair be introduced and increase slowly, from many enemies, so as often to intermarry. Who will dare say what result?" According to this view, animals on separate islands ought to become different if kept long enough apart, with slightly different circumstances. Now Galapagos tortoises, mockingbirds, Falkland fox, Chilo fox, English and Irish hare. Without question, this process of adaptation can and does go on. This is the process the Grants have documented in such detail in Darwin's Islands. The adjustments they saw the birds make after the drought and the flood are the kinds of changes the finches' ancestors would have made when they landed in these islands for the first time. Each year, Daphne is a new island, and its finches adapt to it from generation to generation. The work that began when their ancestors first landed on the island is never finished. But Darwin's finches are not marooned. Each species to its own island. On average, there are 7 or 8 species to each island in the archipelago. Beyond that, there is the constant traffic of visiting finches. The birds may have diverged, or have begun to diverge, in isolation, but they are not in isolation now. What happens when lines of life that have begun to diverge in isolation meet up again? Darwin has an answer, and it is one of the most original steps in his argument. "I can remember the very spot in the road, whilst in my carriage, when to my joy the solution occurred to me," Darwin recalls in his memoirs, "and this was long after I came to Down." By then, more than 10 years had passed since Darwin had seen the Galapagos. He had already written out a very brief abstract of his secret theory, 35 pages in pencil. He had expanded this abstract into a longer sketch of 230 pages and copied out the whole draft in a fair hand. He had kicked innumerable flints. Yet it was not until that moment, riding on the road, that Darwin felt he really understood the branching of the tree of life. What drives the branches to diverge again and again? How, then, does the lesser difference between varieties become augmented into the greater difference between species? Suddenly, Darwin perceived that adaptation to isolated specks of land is not the whole answer. He saw a way that natural selection acting on local varieties, species in the process of formation, in Darwin's view, incipient species, would drive wedges between these varieties and push them apart everywhere on Earth. For Darwin, it was like the Eureka in the legend, when Columbus peers at a butterfly perched on an egg, imagines the Earth in the palm of his hand, and suddenly perceives the obvious. It was as if Darwin had taken a few giant mental steps back and, craning his head, stared up for the first time at the whole tree of life. His vision had nothing to do with star-crossed lovers and the meetings and matings of hybrids. It was more like a vision of war. What Darwin realized is that two varieties living side by side are thrown into competition. Competition in a very large sense. like the contest the Grants are now watching among ground finches on Daphne Major. Individuals in each of two neighboring varieties will usually find themselves going after the same thing as their neighbors, precisely by virtue of their similarities, like two big-beaked ground finches hunting for the same tribulus seed. In the struggle for existence, one variety or species must often squeeze another. Nearest neighbors, closest cousins, will pinch each other very hard generation after generation. They collide because they are so much alike in equipment, instincts, and needs. Again, like finches scrabbling through the cinders of Daphne Major for the last tribulus seed, the more alike the varieties, the more frequently they will find themselves going for the same seed, the same nook, the same niche, at the same time. Competition through kinship. An exceptional individual will benefit under these conditions. Any escape, however partial, from that oppressive competition will be an enormous release, almost like finding a fresh island. The lucky individual that finds a different seed or nook or niche will fly up and out from beneath the Sisyphean rock of competition. It will tend to flourish, and so will its descendants. That is, those that inherit the lucky character that had set it a little apart. Individuals that diverge from the madding crowd will tend to prosper, while the rest will be ground down. Selection will act in this way on all neighboring varieties, not just on islands, but everywhere on the planet, and the effect will be continually to move varieties apart and repel them. Even if they never actually jostle and joust, never once collide physically over a tribulus seed or a nesting site in a crook of cactus, natural selection will gradually magnify their differences. At last, the two varieties will move so far apart that competition will slack off. It will slack off when the two varieties have evolved in new directions, when they have diverged. Natural selection will have led, in effect, to another adaptation, the mutual adaptation of two neighbors to the pressures of each other's existence. And the result of this sort of adaptation would be forks in the road, parting of the ways, new branches on the tree of life, the pattern now known as adaptive radiation. In Darwin's view, then, each line of life is forever reaching for its spot of sun. Competition among slightly divergent forms everywhere on the planet leads continually to new branches, radiating outward in all directions like a compass rose or the arms of a medieval sun. Darwin called this his principle of divergence. Again, Darwin never actually saw it happen, though he argued that it could happen, had to happen, and had happened. He pointed to his pigeons. Pigeon fanciers enjoy novelty, and they often cultivate the extremes. With tumbler pigeons, breeders had spent several centuries choosing and breeding from birds with longer and longer beaks, or with shorter and shorter beaks, Darwin notes in The Origin. As a result, the breeders had created two sub-breeds out of one, a long-beaked and a short-beaked tumbler. In Darwin's view, natural selection, too, would tend to make nature more and more diversified. Here the motor is not whim, taste, or love of novelty, as with the pigeon fanciers, but something more basic. The great thing is efficiency, or what the economists of Darwin's day were already calling the division of labor. It is obvious, Darwin writes in Natural Selection, that more descendants from a carnivorous animal could be supported in any country, if some were adapted to hunt small prey and others large prey. Likewise with herbivores. More could be supported if some were adapted to feed on tender grass and others on leaves of trees and others on bark, roots, hard seeds, or fruit. In other words, as varieties and species ramify, they will become better and better consumers of the world around them, like Jack Spratt and his wife, who between them licked the platter clean. The advantage of divergence is, in fact, the same as that of the physiological division of labor in the organs of the same individual body. Darwin writes in The Origin. There are certain relatively simple animals in which the stomach ingests both food and air and carries out both digestion and respiration. But a stomach specializing in digestion and a pair of lungs specializing in respiration can each do better work. No wonder Darwin remembered the exact spot in the road for the rest of his life. It is an extraordinary vision. Natural selection literally organizes life. The process of evolution by natural selection works right up the tree, from individuals to varieties, varieties to species, onward and upward, branching and branching, always diverging, helping to create all the myriad life forms on the planet. Whole lines die out as inevitably as individuals die out, but the result is always something new and alive. The tree grows. In this view, natural selection is even more powerful than Darwin first imagined. It is both beautiful and terrible, an agent of creation and destruction, like the flaming sword at the gates of Eden, which turned every way to keep the way of the tree of life. Darwin's principle of divergence has fascinated generations of biologists. But the process is not easy to observe and measure in action because it erases its own traces. In fact, Darwin's thesis predicts the general absence of competition. In his view, competition drives neighbors far enough apart that they are no longer locking horns or locking beaks. The Grants, for instance, can see that Fortis and Magnerostris on Daphne Major are competing for tribulus seeds. But how can they measure competition among the species that are no longer competing, like the cactus finches and the fuliginosa? If the finch unit finds the 6 species of ground finches living more or less harmoniously now, how do they know it was competition that drove them into relative harmony? Was the agent Darwin's principle of divergence? Where can they catch the gleam of the ever-turning sword? Again, this is one of the most contested questions in all of Darwin's theory, and Darwin's finches have been at the center of the controversy ever since David Lack published Darwin's Finches in the middle of the last century. The book created so much excitement because Lack announced that the beaks of the finches were in fact produced by Darwin's principle of divergence. All of the low-lying islands in the archipelago, for example, have either the small ground finch or the sharp-beaked ground finch, either fuliginosa or difficilis. The low islands never have both. The taller islands in the archipelago do hold both species, and there the two species keep more or less apart. Fuliginosa tends to gather around the base of the island, difficilis near the top. In his mind's eye, Lack saw this pattern as the aftermath of a great war across the whole archipelago, a war without generals or bloodshed, between the sharp beaks and the small beaks. Apparently, Lack said, these two species are so alike that whenever they breed side by side on the same island, they are thrown into competition. If the island has only one niche for them, then either the line of the sharp beaks or the line of the small beaks is driven to extinction. One species outcompetes the other. The technical term for this outcome of a battle between two groups of living things is competitive exclusion. But if the island is tall enough to offer one species a new niche, a path out of the race, that species can evolve its way out of the competition. Then it changes in character. The beak bends, melts, morphs, changes shape. Through evolution by natural selection, until that lineage of birds is freed from the dreadful war. The technical term for this outcome is character displacement. Lack pointed out that on Santa Cruz, the small beaks are small and the medium beaks are medium. On Daphne, where there are very few small beaks, the medium beaks have become smaller. On Los Hermanos, where there are very few medium beaks, the small beaks have become larger. Lack saw this same pattern with many other pairs of finches in the islands, again and again traces of character displacement. In the 1950s and 1960s, Lack and others explored competition theory and its ramifications. They pursued the theory so triumphantly and unanimously that a few ecologists and evolutionists with other interests began to feel competitively excluded. One of them was an American ornithologist, Robert Bowman, who went to the Galapagos in 1952 after Lack and studied the Galapagos finches as his thesis project. This was before the invention of mist nets. To find out what the finches were eating, Bowman shot them by the hundreds and inspected the contents of their stomachs. He decided that what a Galapagos finch eats does depend on its beak, a conclusion that would later be confirmed and extended in such extraordinary detail by the Grants International Finch Investigation Unit. However, Bowman also noticed, more than Darwin or Lack had noticed before him, that Galapagos plants, like Galapagos finches, vary from island to island. Bowman wondered if this variation in itself might explain the branching of the finches' lines. The birds might have evolved their distinctive beaks and habits by adapting to the local varieties of flowers and seeds as they settled on island after island. They might have speciated, in other words, according to Darwin's first vision of the evolutionary process, before his eureka in the carriage. That was a simpler story, Bowman argued, and who could prove it wrong? Time and again, Bowman watched the sort of mixed flocks that Darwin himself had noted when he first got off the Beagle. Time and again he saw four or more species of ground finches feeding in the very same bush, small peaceable kingdoms of ground finches. And since there is no direct evidence that competition is occurring at the present time, Bowman declared in his thesis, I see no logical reason to assume that it must have occurred in the past. To argue that the absence of competition is a proof of its power seemed to Bowman infuriatingly circular reasoning. There were other ecologists who agreed with him. A pitched battle began between the competitive camp and the non-competitive camp, and in the absence of hard evidence and actual observations, it dragged on and on. The ecologist Joseph Connell declared in a celebrated manifesto that until someone came along with harder facts, he would no longer buy the old guard's arguments for Darwin's principle of divergence. I will no longer be persuaded by such invoking of the ghost of the competition past. The ecologist, Daniel Simberloff, was even more emphatic. He argued that Lack's famous patterns might be nothing more than the faces we see in the moon, in clouds, in Rorschach inkblots. Even if we see species living together in different niches, that does not prove that they drove each other into those niches, that they repelled each other like the identical poles of two magnets. They might instead have diverged by random adaptations toward different seeds and different needs. Finches colonizing the islands at random would have produced patterns that could be interpreted in all kinds of ways. The finches' distributions in the archipelago might be most fruitfully treated as a random process. Peter Grant suspected that Lack was right. But he too was annoyed by Lack's dogmatic style, his willingness to issue pronouncements without having seen what is actually going on. Grant once accused Lack in print of a distressing lack of objectivity. Future generations, he wrote, will surely wonder that we discuss competition so much, yet know it so little and measure it even less. That was one of the fascinations of the events the Grants witnessed in their first dry season, events they still see repeated each year. Again and again, when the rains end, their flocks of Darwin's finches move apart and specialize, Magnirostris going this way, Fortis that way, Scandens and Fuliginosa going off on their own as well, each according to its beak. Not only does this divergence help to prove that the beaks of the finches are adaptive, it also helps to prove that their differences have survival value. It suggests that the forces Darwin envisioned in his carriage more than a century ago are at work right now among his finches. When birds that have been eating the same foods for months begin to fan out into specialties, according to the sizes and shapes of their beaks, we are seeing a kind of divergence in the course of a single season. And we can also see that the consequence is just what Darwin imagined. For as each dry season wears on and the birds are scrabbling for food, their choices as they hunt and peck diverge more and more, which reduces the competition between them. That they respond to the drought in this way, in effect making room for one another, may help to explain why they are able to coexist on the little island at all. Of course, in the dry season, the birds are only changing their behavior, not their beaks. Their diets diverge as their stocks of food are depleted, because so many individual birds stop trying to do everything and concentrate on what they do best, according to the beaks and bodies they were born with. Changing your behavior is much quicker than changing your anatomy. But the change is driven by the same sort of competition. Darwin's finches are responding to the same forces that Darwin believed led to their creation. The traditional picture of the economy of nature, the picture that most of us learned in school, is that nature is a stiff hierarchy, a food pyramid of more or less rigid trophic levels. Plants are at the bottom of the pyramid, making food from sunlight. Herbivores feed on the plants, and carnivores feed on the herbivores. Within each level, there are assorted specialists called guilds. Any ecologist can rattle off long lists of them. Leaf eaters, stem borers, root chewers, nectar sippers, bud nippers. Much like the feudal guilds of shoemakers, tailors, butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers. As more and more ecologists and evolutionists watch life up close and long term, the way the Grants are observing Daphne Major, they see that these categories are not as fixed as they had imagined. More and more naturalists are shifting their efforts from the study of pattern and structure to the study of process and motion, watching change through time and, like the finch unit in the Galapagos, what they see again and again is the lesson of Heraclitus. Everything flows. Nature is fluid.